Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A campaign finance law goes down over the principle that corporate contributions equal speech.
So it's just going to be more money overall for everybody and more painful 30-second sound bites for all the public to have to endure.
Happy days are here again.
Campaigns cost money. Speech is free. So if I had a nickel for every 30-second soundbite I've ever heard, I'd be Warren Buffett. The devaluing of political currency, or there's gold in them thar soundbites.
Happy days are here again.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, January 22nd, and The Takeaway is, if a speech is free, does this decision devalue political speech or actually give it more value?
And how much did you just make doing that?
the answer, nothing. We have one more shot at Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee today, and it's been great having you here this week.
Had a good week. I've enjoyed it. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. As we've been talking about, in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court says big business and labor unions have a right to spend as much money as they want in elections. It comes down to freedom of speech. And in its ruling, the court cited, in effect, that money equals speech.
And for more on that doctrine, let's talk with Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and senior legal correspondent for Slate.com. Good morning, Dahlia.
Good morning.
So campaign finance reform is something of a joke, it seems to me, as long as there is this principle that money equals speech and that that's inviolate. Is that what this is all about?
Well, there's always been a lurking principle, at least for a while now, that money equals speech and that corporate money equals speech. What the court really did was take off all restraints on that speech. In other words, it used to be that even though the court generally accepted that money was speech, you could regulate it some for greater interests of political fairness. Those days are over. From here on in, according to Justice Kennedy's 5-4 opinion, all bets are off and speech is good.
And you can take that to the bank. Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and senior legal correspondent for Slate.com. We'll be talking about this story all throughout the show.
President Obama took on Wall Street yesterday, calling for tougher regulations that would limit the size of banks and limit their ability to engage in high-risk trades.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform.
The president's plan would also stop banks from making investments that are not meant to benefit customers. The markets tumbled on the news, the Dow Jones losing 213 points.
Now to Haiti, where a massive relocation of 400,000 people is being planned. UN peacekeepers are leveling land on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince and say the relocation could start next week. Search and rescue teams, meanwhile, are packing up their dogs and gear as hopes for finding survivors dim. This USAID worker describes the mood.
There's like a great pallor of gloom among the population. There's a very deep depression among the people. It's very evident here.
More on Haiti from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. The second part of my interview continues in just a moment.
And some political promises are more easily kept than some are more easily made than kept, I should say. Here, want proof? Today is the anniversary of President Obama's pledge to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. Didn't happen, did it? The base in Cuba still houses nearly 200 terror suspects, and no one at the White House can say when it will close. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116. The NASDAQ at 2,265. Coming up in the show.
It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
Who'd want to bust the filibuster? Lots of our listeners do, and we take a look into the history and details of the process later this hour.
And with that Supreme Court decision that money is speech, we're talking with you all this morning. How do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for manipulating the system? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or our website, thetakeaway.org. Does this devalue speech or raise its value? Coming up, more of my conversation with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, on the Haitian relief effort.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
and Miles O'Brien. Miles, it's been great having you here this week.
It's been a good week. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, Celeste will be back on Monday. And during my 2 days down in Washington, you'll recall I was out of here for a while.
In the midst of
the political crisis created by that special Senate race up in Massachusetts, and there were all kinds of typical briefings and meetings on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was the relief effort in Haiti that had the highest profile at the White House. Government agencies from Health and Human Services to USAID to the Pentagon were rapidly mobilizing. And it's estimated there are close to 16,000 U.S. troops there right now as part of the effort. In part two of our interview with Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, we talked about the challenges in Haiti, and especially in opening up that logjam at the damaged airport in Port-au-Prince.
Well, when we went in there initially, we really brought the enabling capability to make the airport 24/7 capable. Since that time, we've worked very hard with the Haitian government to essentially put ourselves in a position to run the airport. And we've increased the throughput several fold. I just actually literally got off the phone with General Frazier, who's the commander at Southcom. He went down there yesterday, and one of the first things he mentioned was what a tremendous operation the airport is in terms of what it's doing right now. And as the principal place to get stuff into Haiti initially, the only place we could do that, that's been really important.
How much has that impressive throughput and increase of capacity there at the airport due to the forces really having to hold territory and control that airport because, of course, the tower was damaged?
Well, it wasn't really tied to holding territory per se. Certainly, security there has been important, but I've received no input that there's been any kind of incidents in the vicinity of the airport or any kind of serious instance at all. So what was really key was getting in there and enabling it. And we knew this right away, as rapidly as we could. What the challenge has been, because it has been the principal place where all the relief comes in, has been prioritizing it. And then after the prioritization and arrival, is distributing it, which is where we are right now in the overall task.
How does what appears to be U.S. control of the airport at Port-au-Prince conflate with the idea that the Haitians are in control of their own destiny right now? We've heard reports that the police are essentially AWOL in a lot of the urban areas and that the responsibility of the government is very, very difficult to discern right now.
Well, we've worked with the Haitian leadership from the beginning. I mean, we are there in support of the Haitian leadership. Overall, the UN in terms of the relief efforts and in particular the UN security forces supporting them from a security standpoint. But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort. So as we've approached this and recognize we're a big footprint, and I understand all that, the intent is from, and certainly from the military standpoint, the intent is to focus on this kind of assistance in support of these organizations, including the Haitian government, to relieve the really destitute situation in so many places as rapidly as we can. We also, the U.S. military is not the lead, even in our own country. It's USAID, so we're working very closely in support of USAID as well.
That's Admiral Michael Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I spoke with him Wednesday at the Pentagon. And we went on to discuss the capabilities of the Haitian government, the tough situation for that government in this time of critical need.
I'm not aware of the impact that the difficulties the Haitian government has had in standing up. I mean, and it was in great part decapitated by this. They lost a lot of senior people. They also lost a lot of ministries. So it's in its own way trying to stand back up as well. So I haven't seen them impeding progress here. We certainly are in touch with them about what's going on. And again, there's a big international medical effort right now. And as literally as we speak, a little more than a week after the earthquake, while we still have a long way to go with food, a long way to go with water, a great emphasis right now is being placed on getting the medical help out there. The The Navy ship, United States Navy ship Comfort, showed up today that has the capacity for 1,000 beds. And we hope that that will assist. There's been an offer of another hospital ship as well. So, but there are clear challenges, significant challenges, that remain on the medical side that we're really trying to break through.
You know, we've talked with lots and lots of Haitians over the last week or more. And to a person, they tell us, we don't trust the Haitian government. We don't know who to trust inside Haiti for the relief that we need and for our faith in the future of our country.
Right.
Can you tell the Haitian people at this point, at this stage of the relief operation, who they can trust?
Well, I have great confidence in the leadership of the United Nations, the senior representatives that are there. I have great confidence in certainly the leadership in USAID and our military leadership and other leaders from many other countries. We are, as I indicated, we are there working very closely to support the Haitian government. And they are a very important part of all this. Again, they've been very badly, almost decapitated. And so I think it's, you know, it's going to take them a while to stand back up. What I guess what I'd say to the Haitian people is there is no one that I know, from their government through all the support agencies, including those from America and many countries around the world, that don't want to do anything else than help them, certainly in the near term, get this relief done, ease this burden, which has been so tough on them because of this tragedy. All of us, there isn't a moment in any of this that myself and many others don't think about all of the people who've died in this, and that just the epic tragedy that this is, and we want to try to relieve that. And I know everyone, including the Haitian government leadership, wants to do that as well.
Hopes and challenges in the Haitian relief effort. That was Admiral Michael Mullen, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, speaking with me at the Pentagon this week. You can see a video of our entire interview on the website, takeaway.org. And it's 15 minutes after the hour, so let's check in on some headlines that we're following. Miles?
The president focuses on jobs today as he meets with workers and business owners in Ohio, a state hit hard by the recession.
We're working every day to get our economy back on track and put America back to work. Because while Wall Street may be recovering, you and I know your main streets have a long way to go.
The trip is the second stop on President Obama's White House to Main Street tour. Sticking with the economy now, the president says he's prepared to fight for new regulations on big banks.
The American people will not be served by a financial system that comprises just a few massive firms. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
The proposed rules limit the size of banks. We'll get more on that story from New York Times finance reporter Louise Story in just a few minutes.
A divided Supreme Court overturned a longtime ban and ruled that the government can't restrict how much corporations and others spend on election advertising. Daryl West from the Brookings Institution explains the decision.
It doesn't affect candidates so directly because it doesn't relate to money that you would give to a candidate, but it does allow corporations to spend an unlimited amount of money on behalf of candidates that they support.
The justices said previous restrictions violated free speech. The White House and Democrats denounced the ruling, and we'd love to have your opinion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Finally, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the U.S. has no designs on Pakistan's nuclear weapons or a single inch of Pakistani soil. He's in the country on a South Asian tour. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the president restricts the banks. Markets react. So does Louise Story in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Huge takeouts this morning in finance and sports, and was it a good week or a bad week? You decide. We'll find out in a moment. But first, the famous words of bank robber Willie Sutton when asked why he robbed banks. Because that's where the money is. And that's certainly where the president thinks the money is.
Banks will no longer be allowed to own invest, or sponsor hedge funds, private equity funds, or proprietary trading operations for their own profit, unrelated to serving their customers.
Joining us is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Well, the president spoke, the markets tumbled, and this was some tough rhetoric out of the White House. What does it mean?
It's tough rhetoric, John, but, you know, I think that some people would say where the money is not in the banks. I think some people would say where the money is every January is in the bank workers' pockets when they get paid their bonuses.
Right.
And so it's not a coincidence that you're seeing, just as Wall Street workers get these massive bonuses, you're seeing the White House take a very populist stance with much stricter rules and policies and ideas for Wall Street. You know, it was just a week ago that they're coming out about taxing the banks. This week he's coming out in strong favor of the Consumer Protection Agency, which some people thought was going to be dead in Congress. And now, yesterday, you're right, he proposed, you know, what is viewed as a very, very strong approach, the strongest of his administration to the financial crisis.
And something he could have done.
Something
as
he
you
could
were saying
have
yesterday,
done a year ago.
A year ago.
And for some reason, he now has decided to take a hard stance. So what he said is three things. One, there can be no proprietary trading of banks. That's when a bank trades for its own books. Like, you know, all those mortgage bonds that the banks held that ended up causing the massive write-downs.
Right.
They were holding those on their own books. So one, they can't do that. Two, they cannot own stakes or investments in hedge funds or private equity firms. And those have proven to be incredibly profitable for banks like Goldman. They let their workers invest in them, and those turned out big returns and paid big bonuses. Three, he said, these banks cannot do any more acquisitions that will make them larger. The largest banks cannot grow bigger than 10% of all banking liabilities. And that is very interesting because, of course, it was the government during the financial crisis that pushed so many banks to merge together. So that's a bit of a reversal of the historical timeline here.
Louise Story, I guess if I'm sitting at one of those exotic finance desks over at Goldman Sachs or Citigroup, I'm a little worried about my job maybe this morning. Who knows? Louise Story, thanks so much.
Sports takeout time. This is a big weekend for football fans. What do you say? Yeah, the New Orleans Saints hosting the Minnesota Vikings, NFC Championship there, the Indianapolis Colts and the Jets. They're from New York, right, Ibrahim?
Oh, yeah.
Our takeaway sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Hey, let's. We pulled an interesting little cut from the archives here. Let's listen.
First plays that I've been in the NFL right now have not been the best. Last year against Washington, I came in and a ball got deflected and the guy picked it, went in for a touchdown. And preseason this year, the first pass I throw is a bomb for an interception. Then I come in the regular season, the first pass I complete to myself. So it's hopefully I'll do a lot better on my first passes from now on.
That's Brett Favre.
So that was Brett Favre in 1992 when he was the starting quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. It's been a long time since then, and I'm wondering today whether we're going to have a storybook performance, a storybook ending for Brett Favre. It started off kind of rusty, but now he is one of the most pure. He certainly has a Hall of Fame career. So these are the keys, I think, for the victory for each team. First of all, the offensive line of the New Orleans Saints has to perform. The Vikings have a vicious pass rush led by Jared Allen. And if they can't stop Jared Allen, they will not win the game.
That could hurt an old man if they got through that line.
It could certainly hurt an old man. The other thing is Adrian Peterson, the running back for the Vikings, he hasn't rushed for over 100 yards in 8 games. He cannot fumble the football. He has a propensity to let go of the football. So does Brett Favre. Now, if the Saints can get them to fumble the ball or if they can get the Vikings to throw an interception, then the Saints will win the game. And that is the key to the game. Whoever wins
turnovers.
The turnover and takeaway ratio will win this game.
All right, we will watch for it. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Our last takeout, it's Friday. It's fair to say Obama had a pretty bad week. Scott Brown probably had a pretty good week. It's our This Week feature. The Week magazine does a good week, bad week feature, and we do one here on the program. We'd love you to nominate someone at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at takeaway.org. Our week segment begins with the voice of Ruth Ottridge.
It is going to get bigger and bigger. If you look at the statistics, it's now, I think, about 45% of British marriages they predict is going to end in divorce. So I think we'll see more and more of these kind of services coming out.
What kind of services? Well, it's not a downer she's talking about. Ruth is the spokeswoman for the Debenham department store in London, where they're setting up a new divorce registry in January. That's the month with the highest number of filed divorces. Now, when you're getting divorced, you can go and buy a gift for
it's
your
a
divorce.
Gift giving right? occasion it, that few indeed. Of us knew of.
So divorces had a good week. Listen.
Divorce is an expensive time with legal fees and things like that. So a divorce list is something where family and friends can help you out with the basics.
Gift certificates to the attorney, or maybe?
Right, there you go.
There you go.
Pay the legal fees. Moving on, it was a bad week to be a 19th century mystery writer, or I think it's fair to say Edgar Allan Poe is more than a mystery writer, but since 1949, a mystery man has been visiting Poe's grave in Baltimore, Maryland, each year on the birthday, only to leave 3 red roses and a half-filled bottle of cognac. But this past January 19th, no show. What was going on?
It could be something as simple as maybe their car broke down, maybe they had the flu, or maybe, just maybe, 2009, which was the bicentennial of Poe, was the last time that they were going to do it.
Or to quote the Raven, nevermore.
Sounds
nevermore.
Like a Poe mystery, yes, indeed.
That was Jeff Jerome, curator of the Edgar Allan Poe House and Museum in Baltimore, Maryland. Jeff has been witness to the posthumous toast since 1977, and although he is sad to see the tradition come to an end, he says he hopes copycats don't take it upon themselves to continue the tradition.
Well, if you've got nominations for who had a good week or a bad week in the news, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine is on newsstands and online now. Coming up, the High Court's decision on campaign finance.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk about the Supreme Court's decision on campaign finance. More in just a few moments. Here are some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court says big business and labor unions have a free speech right to spend as much money as they want in election ads. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dane Struther, a Democratic consultant on many Senate and presidential campaigns. He says the current law had too many loopholes anyway.
The current law has been a charade. I mean, I've been making money. I've been making the television ads and corporate money for years. What we did was call them educational ads, and you never use the word vote for. But you could do anything else you wanted.
More on the landmark ruling is coming up.
In Haiti, a massive relocation of 400,000 people to the outskirts of Port-au-Prince is now being planned by United Nations peacekeepers. And meanwhile, UN General Secretary Ban Ki-moon says the focus in Haiti is shifting from search and rescue now to keep survivors alive.
We will now have to move from emergency response phase to more ongoing relief and early recovery.
Tonight, a 2-hour celebrity telethon to benefit Haiti will air on all the major networks and cable channels. Google appears to have regained its financial stride after wobbling through most of 2009. It made $2 billion in the last 3 months of the year. For the whole year, it raked in $6.5 billion.
It's a lot of searching. Stock markets around the world have fallen after President Obama proposed sweeping new rules to limit the size of risk-taking of Wall Street banks. The Nikkei Index in Tokyo closed down 2.5%. European stock markets have also lost some ground. Banking shares were hit particularly hard. Let's check the markets. Futures down. The Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens 1,116. The NASDAQ at 2,265. Those are some of the stories we're following for you this morning.
So we're talking about that Supreme Court decision, a 5-4 decision. It overturned the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law, which was designed to limit the influence of big business and labor unions on elections. Joining us is Jeff Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. Jeff, let me just go over the doctrines that this court decision apparently affirms here. Number one, corporations are people. Money equals speech. Therefore, there are really no limits to deliver money to political campaigns. Is that, first of all, a surprise? Is that where the law was going, or is this a reversal?
It's a tremendous reversal. Ever since 1907, Congress has said that you can limit corporate direct contributions, and ever since 1947, it said you can limit direct expenditures. So to reach this decision, the court not only had to repudiate that long-settled understanding, but also overturn precedents dating back to 1990. By any measure of judicial restraint, this has to qualify as judicial activism. They repudiated an act of Congress, overturned precedents, and all unnecessarily. They could have decided it on much narrower ground. So it's an extraordinarily broad and troubling opinion.
And I think to many Americans, it's counterintuitive. Listen to one of our listeners, Jeffrey.
Hi, this is Steve calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I don't understand this whole issue with the campaign finance. The First Amendment rights are for persons, United States citizens, not for corporations. Persons, United States citizens, are allowed to vote, not corporations. So why do we grant corporations the right to so greatly influence elections?
So, Jeffrey Rosen, if our listener was talking to Justice Scalia, what might he say in opposition to that argument?
Well, Justice Scalia would say that from the time of the founding, we've treated corporations as groups that have all sorts of natural rights and have protected them. But this is just an unconvincing argument. As Justice Stevens suggested, it's really economic populism that it was the core of the understanding of people ranging from James Madison to Andrew Jackson. And it wasn't until the 1890s that the court said that corporations are people with full constitutional rights. That decision has very shaky roots. And as the listener suggests, it's a very good point that Justice Stevens actually made in the opinion, too. Why can't corporations vote if they have full First Amendment rights?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, but wasn't the die cast then in the 1890s when the corporations were declared to have rights similar to people?
The die wasn't totally cast because we then had a progressive era and a huge backlash against the conservative court that struck down the income tax and that struck down minimum wage and maximum hours laws. And then in the 1930s, after Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court, the Supreme Court seemed to get the message and from 1930s till the present has gotten out of the business of this kind of economic judicial activism. And the question now, which is so fascinating, is for the first time since the 1930s, are we about to have a conservative court challenged by a popular Democratic president? I mean, the fact that Barack Obama had no compunction in challenging the court yesterday suggests that this may be on the verge of a really historic confrontation between the court and the White House.
You know, and this is the second administration for very different reasons. The Bush administration confronted the court on a lot of national security issues. So we're enshrining a real sort of competition between the branches of government here. I can see sort of the historical dimensions of this decision now that you explain it, Jeffrey Rosen. Let's talk a little bit about what the court's behavior looks like. 5-4 decision. Kennedy wrote the majority opinion. What does it mean about the dynamics of this Roberts court?
Well, it's very telling indeed. So when John Roberts came into office, he said at his confirmation hearings that he wanted to be an umpire who called balls and strikes, and then he gave a bunch of interviews to journalists afterward, including me, where he really said, I want to be a uniter, I want to have narrow, unanimous opinions and avoid divisions at all costs. I want to be like John Marshall. So many of us were really waiting to see whether he'd make good on that promise. And this is he failed a historic test in this case by that standard. He could have decided it more narrowly. And it's so interesting to see how angry the liberals feel. Justice Stevens, both in his passionate written dissent and also reading it from the bench yesterday, basically said this whole judicial restraint stuff is nonsense. We can't take you seriously anymore because you're not playing fair. So I really have to say that John Roberts had a historic choice here about what kind of chief justice he wanted to be. And he suggested that he's more interested, as he said in his separate opinion, in getting the law right than in actually caring about judicial restraint, collegiality, and unanimity.
And this sets up the possibility, if the court changes one or two justices again, that we may go back the other way, which has already happened in one iteration, and we're setting up for another one, right?
Well, it's true, except that the justices most likely to retire are liberals who'd be replaced by liberals. So unfortunately, we may have this just polarized combination, the four conservatives, four liberals, with Kennedy in the middle but leaning right for a long time. It's a kind of depressing prospect.
Let me take you in a totally different direction then. I mean, there are a lot of people who look at campaign finances and the participation of the electorate as the sort of counterweight and say that campaign finance reform was never in this domain anyway, that real campaign finance reform is what happened in the 08 election, where suddenly smaller and smaller contributors using digital technology really elevated the Obama campaign, and that's the antidote to corporate giving. It's increased small contributions and a larger participation by the electorate. Forget about these McCain-Feingold bills. What do you say to that?
You know, it might work for a presidential election when you've got a highly popular and charismatic leader with a national base, but I'm not sure that it works in a local election or a Senate election where incumbents really can swamp their opponents by using corporate money. Now, it's hard to predict how this will play out. Right now, Democrats are unhappy, but you could imagine in 2 years, General Motors running ads in Michigan praising Obama for the bailout. So the effects of this are, the partisan effects are not necessarily obvious, but the really scary prospect is the idea that you can have retaliation. So someone votes against a corporate interest, and the corporation just floods him with attack ads and supporting his opponent. Right now, there are disclosure requirements, but Clarence Thomas even questioned those, so you could even have anonymous corporate money that was supporting some people and attacking others.
But in theory, on the disclosure requirements, if they stick, does that mean we're going to have attack ads that end with brought to you by Exxon?
Right now, Exxon would be reluctant to do that because they would have to identify themselves. And the real question is the Senate and is Congress now going to have further disclosure requirements, actually forcing the CEO of Exxon to have his face appear
wow.
on the ad before it runs? That's where the next part of the debate is going to run.
Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University. Thanks for a great discussion on the 5-4 Supreme Court decision that was handed down yesterday. Coming up.
It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
Todd Zwillick on the history of the filibuster, coming up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien and for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and this is Based on a True Story.
Dr. Stonehill.
Yeah.
This is John Crowley.
All the researchers out there say that you're a genius on the verge of a scientific breakthrough.
I'm not on the verge of anything.
How much would it take to prove your theory?
It's a clip from Extraordinary Measures, which opens today, starring Harrison Ford and Brendan Fraser, about a couple's struggle to find a cure for their daughter's rare form of cancer. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, joins us. Rafer, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Among the movies coming out this weekend, The Tooth Fairy, and I'm fine, by the way. My wife tells me I have to actually answer that question from now on.
All right.
The Tooth Fairy, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. He's a minor league hockey player who's sentenced to spend 1 week as the Tooth Fairy. And also Legion, an apocalypse movie set in a diner with a pregnant waitress. What do you make of the offerings this weekend, Rafer Guzman?
Well, you know, this is the January-February dead season, so I think you're going to see a lot of this kind of stuff. It's, you know, every year it's the same. I think the studios unload a lot of their stinkers or their bombs or the movies they're not quite sure what to do with or they're not quite convinced are that good. They kind of tend to dump them in January and February, so I think that's why we're seeing this kind of stuff these days.
Now, that's sort of a broad brush indictment of all these films. Among the ones you've seen, anything stand out?
Well, as a kid's film, I guess I would say Tooth Fairy is passable, actually. Dwayne Johnson is fairly decent. And that's got a couple of good screenwriters, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, who did Flash.
Yeah.
So that one was okay. But I think if you're a grown-up and you don't want to take the kids and you're looking for actual grown-up entertainment, Creation, also with Paul Bettany, where he plays Charles Darwin and Jennifer Connelly plays his wife, and he's sort of struggling with his own Christian faith while he's writing Origin of the Species, is not a perfect movie, but it's kind of interesting, and it's got a lot of food for thought, and the acting is pretty good in that.
You know, Rafer, we're seeing a lot of these movies that have, you know, strong literary underpinnings being released by major studios. I mean, on the surface, when you've got Avatar out there, a movie like that just would not have any sort of financial legs to it. But why does something like that get released? It sounds great, but it has no chance.
I guess it has no chance. Again, I think something like this, I've seen the film, and it's a little wobbly on its legs, so I think if this film had been, you know, if the studio felt this was a real knock-it-out-of-the-park kind of movie, they probably would have released that later in the year during Oscar season. So I think maybe that's why you're seeing it kind of slide in under the radar during these kinds of dead winter months. But still, like I say, a pretty decent film.
You know, I'm maybe surprising you with this, but I was shocked to see that this movie, The Last Station, about Tolstoy's sort of the last months of his life, got made. That sort of seems to be in the same category as this.
I think these kinds of movies, I think everyone is always looking for that last unexplored angle on, you know, the famous author, the famous figure, that one little slice of his life that we haven't seen yet. And so I think they're always trying to find that. And I think, again, you know, hoping that it'll become some kind of sensation that, you know, it'll boost book sales, it'll boost DVD sales.
Like Shakespeare in Love.
Like Shakespeare in Love, exactly.
Right,
that kind
Water
of thing.
For Chocolate, that's probably another one, yeah.
Right.
All right, well, Rafer Guzman, you know, have a great weekend, will you, buddy?
Thanks. I'll do my best. You too.
All right. Don't see too many movies. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. and all of his movies about the cinema, his theories about the cinema. We love Rafer.
It's like work for him. I mean, it's not. What is he?
You know, I don't think it is work for him. He has a great job, and he's a happy guy.
Yeah. Good.
Who are you?
I'm the Tooth Fairy. Oh yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning to you. I'm Miles O'Brien, and for Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, the Democrats lost their filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. But why does a filibuster matter? We'll talk with our D.C. correspondent, Todd Zwillick, in just a few moments.
He knows the answer.
Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The floodgates have officially opened for Washington lobbyists. Thanks to yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, big businesses and unions can now spend as much as they want to sway presidential and congressional elections. Darrell West of the Brookings Institution said the ruling would have immediate effects.
We will see an arms race of campaign spending in upcoming elections.
In Haiti, the focus has shifted from search and rescue to relief. To help keep disease from spreading, officials are planning a massive relocation of 400,000 people from makeshift camps to the outskirts of the capital. Meanwhile, some survivors are struggling to get supplies. Louis Belager, a spokesman for Oxfam in Great Britain, said the weak and elderly are at particular risk.
In the case of, you know, people dying of hunger or thirst, very often it's because they just could not reach the point where aid is actually being distributed.
Well, we've been talking with reporters all morning, and again, there are patches where that aid is not getting distributed. Nick Davis of the BBC was talking about that. Finally, here at home, it's a bit of a comedic story, but it's also a tragedy, and it's emblematic of what goes on in the air these days. A praying Jewish boy has prompted the latest scare in aviation. A New York to Kentucky flight diverted to Philadelphia yesterday when a Jewish teenager pulled out boxes of scrolls for morning prayers. The commuter plane was greeted by police, greeted by bomb-sniffing dogs and federal agents. The teen and his sister were later cleared to travel. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Senator Smith has not talked for 23 hours and 16 minutes. It is the most unusual and spectacular thing in the Senate annals. One lone and simple American holding the greatest floor in the land.
Get up there with that lady! That's up on top of this Capitol dome, that lady that stands for liberty. Take a look at this country through her eyes if you really want to see something.
You know, they don't filibuster like they used to, do they? The idea that a solitary senator can start talking and keep talking and talking and talking for hours to stop some legislation, as they did in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, is now a quaint notion. We've been talking about this, dare we say, filibustering, about this all week because of the Senate election in Massachusetts, of course. You heard about that one, right? Many, many listeners have written us and sent us their comments one way or another to mytake@thetakeaway.org or called us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE with their reactions. Todd Zwillick has been looking at some of these reactions. He's our Washington correspondent. He hopped on the Acela, and he's here with us in New York. Good to see you in person, Todd.
Hey, good morning, Miles.
Good morning. Two sets of comments from our listeners. Those who blame the rule.
The filibuster rule is a disaster for democracy. Since most of our senators are, in fact, bought and sold by campaign contributions, nothing of any significance, nothing of any fundamental strength will ever get through. And somehow or other, whether it's done through the Supreme Court, it has to be eliminated. Filibusters destroy change.
And then there are listeners who blame how politicians play the game.
The 60-vote rule is not the problem. The problem is that the Republicans, they are marching lockstep with only the political goal of ruining the president. That's the reason the Senate is dysfunctional, not the rules.
Which is it, Todd?
Yeah, it's do you hate the player or hate the game, right? That's the question in the modern parlance. You know, Miles, the anger over the filibuster and frustration over it is as old as the filibuster. People in the majority always hate it because it prevents the big things they want to do. So in this case today, Democrats across the country or liberal voters are probably livid because filibuster may prevent health care from passing, a big health care bill, or filibuster may prevent another big bill they want from passing. But, you know, in past years, the tables have always been turned. And when the Republicans were in the majority, the Democrats were happy to filibuster. So the filibuster defends the rights of the minority. If you want to run roughshod and get your way and do whatever you want, go be in the House. You know, if you want to have the rights of the minority protected and be a little bit more deliberative and have to sit and talk and decide things and gain consensus, that's why they have it in the Senate.
Which founding father said it? The Senate is the saucer that cools the
I think
hot
it's George
coffee.
Washington. Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas
I think.
Jefferson. Yeah. Said. All right. So here, let's listen to another listener explaining why the filibuster matters.
If you didn't have the 60-vote supermajority rule, many issues would go back and forth every time the majority in Congress changed, and it'd be chaos.
So is that the reason to keep filibusters around?
It's a reason to keep filibusters around. That's what consensus does. It lets you pass bills that have staying power. If you could pass a gigantic health care bill, a big health care overhaul worth $1 trillion with 50 votes or 51 votes, well, in two elections when the other side's in control, they'll just repeal it. That's no way to run a system.
So maybe a supermajority is a good thing. All right. You talked also yesterday to the congressional historian, Donald Ritchie.
People have wanted to end the filibusters ever since they were filibusters. Whoever is the majority party has been elected to carry out its agenda. But the rules of the Senate have always given more power, more muscle to the minority. And that's always frustrated the majority, regardless of which party is in the majority.
So it just goes back and forth. The pendulum swings. Yeah, the math changes, and it's just a different group of people
carping, right? But it has evolved, though, right? I mean, it hasn't always been used all the time.
It seems like it's used more, right?
Yeah, that seems true.
And it depends on what you define as a filibuster. Today, any objection that then requires 60 votes, and we won't get down into the weeds, that's called a filibuster. Today, the term filibuster no longer applies to standing on the Senate floor and reading the phone book.
Because they don't actually do that.
They don't actually do that.
Maybe they should.
Well,
and see it on C-SPAN.
Careful what you wish for, John. You want to give lawmakers even a larger platform to say whatever they want for as long as they want. They'd probably take advantage of it. They can do it if they want to. It's just out of fashion.
Or read from the telephone book.
It might constrain them.
It might just do that.
It might do
the opposite. Virtual filibuster. Who knows? You know, you're right. But that brings us to our next caller anonymously, who says that's part of the problem.
Why don't they change the filibuster rule back to when the guys actually had to speak and
there
waste time?
Smart
As
listener.
It stands now, you know, they bring a bill up. Joe Lieberman says, I filibuster. He can leave and get on, you know, a plane and spend the weekend at his cabin. If they actually had to stand there on C-SPAN and read recipes and let people see them wasting time, that would have a whole different impact. There would be a whole different emotional standing in the country.
I feel like I know this guy.
Yeah.
Did you call that in? So what would it take, though? Is it a simple rule change to require them to stand up there? Is that just a custom that they allow?
It's a cultural shift that they no longer do that. It is not a rules change. The rules on the filibuster, aside from the number that you need, you know, it used to be two-thirds. If you think the filibuster is bad now,
it used to
be 67 until 1975. Now it's only 60. So it's... And before 1917, there was no way to cut off debate. There was no way to end a filibuster.
No cloture.
There was no cloture at all. So, you know, it's careful what you wish for. I'll say this because the Democrats are in control now and Democrats are frustrated now. Back in 2005, when George Bush wanted to pack the courts with his judicial nominees, the filibuster served the Democrats very well. Mm. And that's where you got to the nuclear option. That was because Democrats were threatening to filibuster George Bush's nominee. So back then, they liked it.
You know, I didn't realize the Senate had a historian. Are you like really good pals with him?
Don Ritchie? Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I've interviewed him a million times. He's a great guy.
Todd Zwillick is our Washington correspondent here in New York today. Thanks for being here.
So we've been covering the impact from that Supreme Court decision on corporations and campaign finance. You know, the McCain-Feingold campaign finance bill was struck down, and it basically removes limits. How do you view campaign cash coming from corporations? Is it political expression, or is it a tool for manipulating the system?
This is Mark calling from Westport, Massachusetts. The Supreme Court ruling is going to cause us huge problems, as many candidates are corporations. Look at Ross Perot.
I'm really interested to know if there is any tracking going to be placed on these corporations with the right to speech as to who owns them. Where are their stockholders? Which countries?
We've been hearing from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you think that money is speech?
So if money is speech free, or is it a butterfly dreaming it's a man? It's kind of capitalism then.
Thank you, Grasshopper. Yes, indeed. That was great. I love that. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. It's a corporation dreaming it's a man. Yes, need, like the butterfly.
I need to reflect on that one a little bit.
No, I love
After
that,
After some sleep.
The listeners are great. After some sleep. Yeah, that's right. You're not going to be here.
Yeah,
Celeste
yeah.
West. Yeah. Celeste Headley. Celeste Wesson. Celeste Headley is coming back.
Yeah, I'll phone in my extra insights on that one. While you're there and checking
at
out our site,
right.
We've got a few extras for you to check out. There's a blog post from sports commentator Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. I'm sure he's going on and on about the Jets. He's
talking about the NBA.
The NBA. Yep. Kobe Bryant, who just made his 25,000th career point. Wow. And if you missed our interview with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. John, you did a good job of that one.
Thank you very much, Miles.
You can watch a video with him.
Video, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
You know all about video,
well,
don't you?
Well, you know, it's a multimedia play here, isn't it all these days? Anyway, that's all on thetakeaway.org. Check out the site. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Money talks, or at least pumps up the volume. So no wonder they're shouting about this one.
All parts of the political spectrum, whether you're to the left, in the center, or to the right, politically speaking, this ruling helps everyone equally. It is the ultimate in a nonpartisan issue.
Nonpartisan? In Washington? Nice try.
The Roberts Court has turned back the clock on our democracy by over a century. This disastrous decision paves the way for free and an unlimited special interest spending in our elections.
The Supreme Court opens up the floodgates on vested interest campaign spending. Is it a license to steamroll or a victory for free speech? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. It's Friday, January 22nd. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headley. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Miles. And the takeaway on this Supreme Court decision is who's happy about it. We may talk to one or two of them before the end of this program. Let's get right to the top of the stories that we're following this morning. The top story, of course, is that Supreme Court decision. It ruled yesterday, in effect, that money equals speech. A 5-4 decision. Big business and labor unions have a right now to spend as much money as they want in election ads. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs had this to say about the ruling.
I don't think anybody thinks that we spend too little money on political commercials and on political campaigns.
Joining us now is Dane Struther. He's a campaign consultant, Democratic campaign consultant, a partner in the D.C. firm Struther Duffy Struther. Dane, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, if I'm a campaign director, do I suddenly, read the newspaper and immediately update my Rolodex, make sure I can get in touch with Exxon and AIG?
Well, at least on my side, we won't phone AIG or Exxon, but we'll certainly get to know our brothers in the unions better than we do now. But overall, let me say this. Let the First Amendment ring.
And this is a good thing from your view?
Absolutely. It's been a charade prior to this, quite honestly. Corporations have been running ads for years. I know I've been making them.
All right, Dane Struther, stay with us. We're going to have a debate on this in just a moment. Chris Shays, the former Republican congressman, will be joining us.
The UN says the focus in Haiti is shifting from search and rescue to keeping survivors alive. With an estimated 2 million homeless, a massive relocation of 400,000 people to the outskirts of Port-au-Prince is now in work. Meanwhile, just offshore, the Navy has reinforced the USNS Comfort, that hospital ship, where there are now 11 operating rooms working around the clock. This doctor is helping to airlift hundreds of badly injured Haitians to the ship.
We're trying to get as many people as possible, fill up the aircraft as much as possible to utilize to get everybody out of here as efficiently as possible.
Tonight, a 2-hour celebrity telethon to benefit Haiti will air on all the major networks and cable channels.
President Obama says this is a fight he's now ready to have.
Never again will the American taxpayer be held hostage by a bank that is too big to fail.
The president is calling for new rules to limit the size and risk-taking of Wall Street banks. Bankers say the proposals would restrict lending. Stock markets around the world are down this morning, and this analyst says the president's announcement is to blame.
There's been a big hit on the stock markets throughout the world, really, mainly because of this
increased level of uncertainty.
The Nikkei index in Tokyo closed down 2.5%. European stock markets also lost some ground, banking shares particularly hard hit. On Wall Street, futures are mixed this morning. The NASDAQ is about the only index benefiting from anything this morning. The others are down. Dow gets underway at 10,389. The S&P opens at 1,116, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,265. Coming up in this hour, we're going to talk with John Yoo. He's the lawyer who authored that so-called torture memo from the Bush administration. Does he have any regrets? We're going to ask him. And the Supreme Court made the decision. Money is speech. We're talking with you this morning. How do you view campaign cash? Is it expression or something else?
This is Jeff from Roxbury. It seems to me that if a corporation can't vote, then a corporation shouldn't be discussing who should vote and what they should vote. Corporations might be people in some aspects of the law, but not in elections.
What's your take? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email. We'll debate this subject with Chris Jays, former Republican congressman.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. You know, Miles O'Brien, guys like you and me should be pretty happy this morning.
And tell me why.
Well, for a living, right?
Oh, yes, we do.
Yeah. So if money equals speech, we're rich guys.
Each word?
Oh, yeah.
To ka-ching.
Yeah.
Huh?
I mean, we should be feeling pretty happy this morning. But no. A 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court threw out a law designed to limit the influence of big business and labor unions on elections. The court overturned two of its own decisions, along with a 63-year-old law ruling that corporations and unions may spend as much as they want to support or oppose candidates for president and Congress. A ban on direct contributions to candidates remains in place. It's essentially an enshrinement of the money equals speech doctrine, which one of our analysts we were talking to this morning says has been lurking in the courts for years. This decision is certainly a landmark. And to debate the implications of it, we are joined by a candidate and a campaign consultant. Two different perspectives. One, Republican Chris Jays from Connecticut was a member of the House of Representatives from 1987 to 2009. Good morning, Congressman Jays.
Good morning.
And also joining us once again, Dane Struther, Democratic consultant who's worked on a number of Senate and presidential campaigns. He's a partner in the D.C. firm Struther Strategies. Dane, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Dane, you've already said that you believe this is positive, that it is essentially a return to honesty. Money equals speech. Therefore, there are some clear marching orders for you as a campaign consultant. Chris Jays, what do you think of this decision?
Well, what you have is unequal speech. You don't have one man, one vote. You have those with the dollars rule. But the bottom line is this. You had the Tillman Act in 1907 banning corporate treasury money. You had the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947 banning union dues money. I mean, the irony there was my wife belonged to a union that supported my opponent, and her money, her forced union dues money, went to support my opponent. What kind of free speech did my wife have? And then you have the 1970 campaign law that limits individual contributions. What the court has effectively done is basically say the Tillman Act is out, the Taft-Hartley Act is out, and people who belong to unions will find that their money is going to campaigns they don't support. And corporations with vast sums of money will be able to spend literally millions and millions and millions to negate the one man, one vote concept, the one voice, the one, one person, one voice concept.
So do you say that the same that holds true for union members and what unions might support, that it might be different from what actual union member would support, would also apply to shareholders and corporations, that shareholders who own stock are basically
exactly
supporting a corporate agenda?
It's bizarre. And the point is that individuals were not limited in what they could spend. But now you have an artificial organization, and you had being able to spend unlimited sums. But you had a system that worked. You had political action committees. Corporations could ask their stockholders. They could ask their employees to contribute to political action committees,
right.
and then they could spend the money. The same thing for unions.
All right, Dan.
Let me just tell you the other point that quickly that's
yeah.
very concerning and should be to anyone is that you have really an activist court that is legislating. You had a 5-4 decision supporting the law, and now you have a 5-4 decision opposing the law, and it just shows that who's ever appointed to the Supreme Court, it's not the merit of the issue, it's their own bias that they bring to the court.
Interesting. Dane Struther, what do you say to that?
Where do I begin? Well, for the great irony, quite honestly, is you found one of the few Republicans in the country who's not cheering, one of the few Democrats in the country who is cheering. But I had a piece in the New York Times a few years ago basically saying you're never going to separate money and power. And the truth is, with all respect to the congressman, the current law has been a charade. I mean, I've been making money. I've been making television ads with corporate money for years. What we did was call them educational ads, and you never use the word vote for. But you could do anything else you wanted as an educational ad and lay out any problem your opponent had and say, call that congressman. Tell him we're better than that. So all we're doing now is quite honestly being honest.
Your reason that you have a Federal Elections Commission that didn't believe in the law, and so contrary to the law, they allowed this to happen, and they could have put a stop to it right away.
Well, Chris, let me
agree with Dane. They were a fraud.
Let me get a point of clarification from Dane Struther, though. Okay, fine. Let's just say it's better to be honest about it. But do you think it supports democracy to just sort of jump in the tank of money equals power? And that's sort of what this decision is.
Well, money has equaled power all along. I've worked in hundreds and hundreds of political campaigns, and the person with the most money wins about 90% of the time. The person with the most money 90% of the time is the incumbent. Having said that, it's I'm a former reporter, so I come at this from an ideological bent. It's First Amendment, and it's about disclosure. And if the citizens of Louisiana don't want a United States senator from Exxon, then we can make that decision. But once we know who's paying for what, honestly, as opposed to some fraud, sham entity created Americans for Happiness, which is what we've been doing for years, maybe now we can get to the bottom of who's paying for what.
Chris Shays, do you think disclosure is an incentive here?
The court didn't say that you've got to disclose who it is.
Well, that's why we have Congress.
And frankly, corrupt money beats no money anytime, and I consider this corrupt money.
Well,
and Dane has a vested interest. I mean, I have a vested interest. He has a vested interest. This is more money, frankly, to the guys who put on ads, and they're thrilled to have this.
Now, but is that to say, Chris Shays, if we take Dane Struther's point, that any talk of campaign finance reform is just absurd unless you really amend this principle that money equals speech and that corporations have speech rights?
No. You know what? What's absurd is you have a Federal Elections Committee that is absolutely rejoicing this law because even after we passed the law to prevent corporate and union-dues money in 1907 and to be enforced in 1970, they passed a law that said, you know, you could educate them. That's not education. It's just a fraud using the word education. Tell them to stop stealing money. Call your congressman and tell them to stop stealing money. That's not education.
All right. Chris Shays from Connecticut was a member of the House of Representatives from 1987 to 2009. Dane Struther, at the top of the hour, you called the union folks your union brothers. Would it be more correct to say your union clients before we go?
No question. Absolutely both. My corporate clients.
All right.
But look, that's why we have Congress. Disclosure is the key. Let's pass laws once we finally fix health care. Let's pass laws on disclosure.
Okay.
So everyone knows who's paying for
Dane Struther, with the other view, Dane Struther, a Democratic consultant who's worked on a number of Senate and presidential campaigns, who has a firm in Washington called Struther Strategies. Two views on the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision striking down McCain-Feingold.
Coming up,
it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check the headlines. That was well said, though.
Yeah, thank you.
President Obama dealt a blow to big banks yesterday. He's calling for new limits on their size and their ability to make risky bets. Don't expect him to back down.
If these folks want a fight, it's a fight I'm ready to have. And my resolve is only strengthened when I see a return to old practices at some of the very firms fighting reform.
Bankers aren't happy. They say the proposal would restrict lending, increase risk, and do little to protect consumers. Markets are down in the news. In Haiti, aid groups are preparing more than a dozen sprawling tent cities on the outskirts of the capital for homeless survivors. Former President Bill Clinton is the UN special envoy for the country. He says Haitians will rebuild a stronger country out of the rubble.
The thing that impresses me is how, in the midst of this awful tragedy, they are imagining a future. They understand that for all of the burdens of this, they have a bigger responsibility than ever before to give the Haitian people a different and better future.
Meanwhile, Haitians living in the U.S. began applying for a program that allows them to stay here for at least 18 months under the Temporary Protected Status Program, TPS. Eligible immigrants will be allowed to work here and send money home. Storm-battered Southern California is beginning to dry out after a week of wild storms that flooded streets and caused tornadoes. And Toyota has announced it's recalling 2.3 million vehicles to fix accelerators that stick, causing the car to rev dangerously at high speeds. Corollas, Camrys, and Highlanders, among others, are actually on the recall list.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
A Washington takeout and a media takeout this morning. We begin in Washington, where Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, were you there at this sort of Palin moment that happened on Capitol Hill yesterday?
Video, TV cameras, let's all take a step back. All take a step back.
Senator-elect Scott Brown arrives on Capitol Hill, very much mobbed like Sarah Palin. Were you there?
It was a crush. I was there. Yes, I was there. I recorded that sound, and it got I won't say it got totally crazy. I mean, there's big arrivals there all the time, but there was a mad crush waiting for him to arrive, rolling up to the door of the Russell Building. So Scott Brown, the senator-elect from Massachusetts, of course, paying courtesy calls yesterday. He paid a visit on John McCain. He paid a visit on John Kerry, the senior senator from Massachusetts.
How'd that go?
Very courteous. They said they're going to do a triathlon together when John Kerry's hip is feeling better. They've known each other a long time. You know, these are courtesy calls. The Senate, one of the coins of the realm in the Senate is courtesy. Visit to Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. They had some nice idle chatter back and forth with Harry Reid. So he's not sworn in yet. That'll probably be next week.
Colloquy, they call it, right? Isn't
that, what about?
It says that a bad hair thing.
What about over in the House? They must have just been cheering for him.
Oh, for Scott Brown? Yeah. Well, Scott Brown's election certainly has reset the whole situation in Congress, and everybody's talking about health care. John, you remember, God, even before Christmas, before New Year's, Democrats were in a mad rush to get health care done. We're pushing. We're going to get it done by New Year's. Well, listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, what she said about the mad rush to get health care done yesterday.
We're not in a big rush. Pause. Reflect upon what our possibilities are. See what the support is in the caucus. We have to always go where we can build consensus.
Super slow.
Nancy Pelosi is pulling in the sales on health care. Now, there is more than one rank-and-file member of Congress who is going around saying the big health care overhaul, the giant one, is dead. They're using those words. Now, the leadership is not saying that. They're still saying they still may go for a big package. I want to make that clear. But rank-and-file members are saying that it's dead. They're going to go for a more piecemeal approach. Health reform's not dead. They're still going to try to do some reforms, but not a big, bold Obama reform. The leadership remains to be seen, but support
not exactly out of a limb on that one.
No, and not exactly a strategy. And as Anthony Weiner, congressman, said on our program yesterday, that's sort of three groups sort of off on their own.
That's
now.
Right.
Conservative Democrats, the progressives, and the Republicans.
And the ability to rein them all into one agenda seems to be slipping.
Right. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
All right, let's do a media takeout, shall we? Air America, the liberal radio network that helped boost the careers of Al Franken and Rachel Maddow, is filing for bankruptcy. Chapter 7, ceasing operations after 6 years on the air. It's tough in talk radio if you're not conservative, I think, is the basic gist of it.
That's the lesson there, I would say.
Joining us is Brian Stelter, the crack media reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Brian, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
All right, this one's kind of been brewing for some time. What happened? What was the final nail in the coffin for Air America?
They had been bleeding for a long time, and I think the blood ran out for some reason this week. The final nail in the coffin was that it had rotated five or six times between five or six different owners and different management teams. And the most recent management team said, we tried to keep our heads above water, and the money ran out.
Why is it, Brian, that the Republican conservative talk does so well and liberal progressive talk does so poorly?
You know, talking to a number of former Air America staffers last night, and honestly, now they're all former staffers. So we're talking about people that were happy there and unhappy there, both camps alike. They say conservative radio had a 20-year head start. You know, Rush Limbaugh is on stations with 50,000 watt signals that can reach across several states. Progressive radio simply can't get on those massive stations in many cases. They also say a lot of radio ownership, a lot of radio companies' owners are conservative, both in political take, but also in business practice. It's a risk. Progressive talk was a risk. And frankly, the Rush Limbaughs of the world are less of a risk for those owners.
But Brian,
there's a number of reasons.
Well, yeah. What do you say to the argument, no doubt someone will say it on Fox today, that the reason that Air America is no longer in existence is that the liberal talk radio already exists, the liberal media already exists. It's the New York Times, it's NBC, it's CBS, it's CNN.
Well, you know, there was a blog post by Media Matters, the progressive media watchdogs, last night, saying you can make that claim or you can make the claim that liberal talk doesn't sell and no one wants to hear it. But you can't make both claims. And what I saw online last night were some conservatives trying to make both claims. And I think that's going to be something that will come up today. But, you know, we know that there's a big difference between what Rush Limbaugh says and the journalism that people strive for, even if they don't always quite get there. However, it is true that, you know, people who perhaps are on the left, they've got all these sources online, like blogs, that seem to have replaced, you know, talk radio in some ways as a meeting point online.
All right, and I would submit one other thing as a takeaway on this one. The two big stars, Al Franken, Rachel Maddow, they're not there anymore. They've moved on.
One's a senator.
I've heard that, yeah, and Rachel Maddow's on MSNBC. So, you know, is it a fact that they just didn't have anybody they wanted to listen to?
It was definitely a launch pad for them, and it was also a launch pad for several other radio hosts, not quite as big names, but people who have also started Air America, taken their shows off on their own, and actually done okay, at least by the standards of talk radio. For some reason, people didn't want to be inside that Air America tent. People say it was mismanaged. People say they didn't have a vision for what a talk radio network should be. For whatever reason, those people were able to go off on their own and have a better career elsewhere. However, I think the legacy probably is Rachel Maddow and Al Franken.
Brian Stelter, who writes about the media for our partner, the New York Times. Good to have you with us on the program this morning.
There's also that Ed Schultz guy who's on MSNBC. He was on some Air America stations. Coming up, major telethon for Haiti airs tonight. Could beat all records for giving. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. You can weigh in on anything you hear on the show. Today, we're coming to you specifically about the Supreme Court. It ruled that money is speech. But how do you view campaign cash? Is it political expression or a tool for corruption?
This is Chris from Brooklyn. You guys are talking there like it's doomsday and there is, you know, the days of regulation are over. That's not true. They can regulate through legislation to influence corporate law. And let's hope that they do that.
877-8MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, what could be a record-breaking telethon airs for Haiti tonight. We look at the effectiveness of this kind of giving in a few minutes. Here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. A massive relocation of 400,000 people being planned in Haiti with an estimated 2 million homeless. UN peacekeepers are now leveling land on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince and say the relocation could start as early as next week. The UN also says the focus in Haiti now has shifted from search and rescue to keeping survivors alive. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court says big business and labor unions have a right to spend as much money as they want on election ads. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dane Struther, a Democratic consultant on many Senate and presidential campaigns. He says the current law had too many loopholes anyway.
The current law has been a charade. I mean, I've been making money. I've been making the television ads with corporate money for years. What we did was call them educational ads, and you never use the word vote for. But you could do anything else you wanted.
Disclosure rules remain intact, so an outside group paying for a campaign commercial will have to include a statement taking responsibility.
All right, here's a little investment advice on The Takeaway this morning. If you want 2010 to be a good year, you should root against the New York Jets in the NFL playoff games this weekend. That's because if the Jets lose to the Colts on Sunday, it would mean a good year for stocks. Why? Well, it's a bit of lore known as the Super Bowl stock indicator. Here's how it works. If a team that had its roots in the National Football League wins, the Dow Jones average goes up. If a team from the upstart American Football League wins, then stocks go down. In the 43 years the Super Bowl has been played, it's been correct 81% of the time. So four teams are playing this weekend. Only all three of them have roots in the NFL. The Colts were originally in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Vikings in the NFL. The New Orleans Saints in the NFL. The Jets have no NFL roots. So as long as the Jets don't win the Super Bowl, it should be another great year for stocks. Markets have just opened, and they're down. The Dow's down about 60 points. The S&P down about 6 points. The NASDAQ down about 12, following in tandem with international markets reacting to President Obama's call for regulation of the banks yesterday. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
In a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about charity and about the big telethon tonight and how you can give wisely. But in the meantime, let's go down to Haiti, where earlier we spoke to the BBC's Nick Davis. We asked him about the plan to relocate 400,000 people out of Port-au-Prince and for an update on the effort to get supplies and food to the local population.
Two big questions. First of all, yes, the conditions in these camps, in these makeshift camps which have sprung up all over the city, little tent cities, actually that's actually not the best way to describe them, because they're not really tented. They're just really a patchwork of quilts, of zinc, of anything people can salvage from their homes. Obviously there's no sanitation, conditions are getting pretty bad, far too many children running around in this sort of situation. So the Haitian authorities have set up these villages which are going to be springing up to the north and to the south of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The plan, therefore, to put up to 10,000 people in these specially constructed areas, in these specially constructed villages, so that people can actually start living properly. They can actually start living life the way it should be lived, rather than the squalid conditions which exist in some of these makeshift camps which have sprung up all over the city.
Nick, if you could just tell us where you're standing right now. There's quite a bit of background noise, a lot of people around. I think I hear some music. And just tell us where you are and what you're seeing.
Well, the situation is I'm not actually that far from the airport. It's a little compound which the BBC have managed to get into. It's a small hotel, and there's lots of aid workers here, so we're getting it often firsthand in the evening, what they've seen, what they've been going through, them telling us their experiences. It's quite grim, it has to be said, in terms of what you see when you go around the city. I think you asked me just a short moment ago about aid and what aid is getting around to people in the city. And again, it's patchy. You can go into some areas and you can see water, you can see people getting food, and in others, nothing. There's an area called Cite Soleil, a very notorious ghetto shantytown in Port-au-Prince. And despite the fact it being not too far from here, not too far from the airport, it just seems a bit odd that, you know, US Marines are fanning out to rural areas to deliver food and to get aid to people, when just down the street there are people who haven't eaten for 9 days.
Wow, that's an interesting paradox right there. Nick, and that brings up an important point here. We're about to talk about how people can help and how people should or should not give money to help, but it sounds like it's not lack of money is not the problem. Is that accurate to say?
No, I think money is still important. People shouldn't get to a point where they think there's no point in giving money. The problem is that this is a logistical nightmare. The infrastructure of this country is gone. The government was pretty much decapitated by what has happened. What it needs is some form of proper organisation. The US is working with the UN to do that. But at the moment, things just don't seem to be gelling.
Nick Davis with the BBC in that aid compound there, bringing us up to date. Wow. Thank you very much for that.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know, Clinton was saying the Haitians get to reimagine their country.
That's probably pushing it. If you ask people on the streets there, I think they might give an interesting response to that. Tonight, the American public will be asked to dig even deeper into their wallets. MTV's Hope for Haiti telethon is airing. A lot of celebrities participating, and it's across several channels as well. Ken Berger is the president and CEO of Charity Navigator. It's an organization that evaluates how well charities are operating. And Ken, good to have you with us on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, first of all, about this outpouring. Put this in some perspective for us. It sounds like there's been a tremendous response.
Yes, in 8 days, over $300 million has been raised already. And to put that in some context, during the Asian tsunamis, in the first comparable number of days, it was about half that amount.
Wow.
Whereas in the case of the Katrina, it was about $450 million. But it's definitely up there as one of the all-time greatest examples of American generosity that we've ever seen. And it's also been historic with certain kinds of giving, such as text messaging, that we've never seen anything like it.
Tell us a little bit about this text message giving.
Well, you know, the Red Cross in 2008 raised about $200,000 from text messaging. So far, the Red Cross alone has raised over $25 million just from text messaging. And it really is opening a door to a whole new category of givers. Many much younger givers are participating in this. And so as a consequence of that, it's just been amazing. I mean, I know that when I communicate with my daughter, text messaging is the way. You know, this has just never been seen. And so for the first time, people are taking very seriously that these sorts of means of giving are now seriously on the landscape and will be here from now on.
Well, Ken, help me understand, though, if I give money via text on my phone, is the phone company making money off of this, or are they donating this transmission, if you will?
Normally, the answer to that question would be yes, but all of the major carriers have made a commitment to not have any fees associated with this, and in addition, they've expedited getting the money to the charities. Normally, it would take as much as 90 days for text, believe it or not, for text messaging donations.
There's some irony. Instant giving and 90 days to make sure that somebody pays the
bill. But they've expedited, though.
Right?
That's
good to hear.
That's great to hear.
That's good to hear. Ken Berger, the president and CEO of Charity Navigator, thanks very much, and we'll be watching that telethon tonight.
Coming up, we're going to talk with John Yoo. He's the author of the Bush administration's so-called torture memos. He's now a law professor at UC Berkeley. How does he feel about executive power now? We ask him later this hour. He's written a book about the evolution of executive power throughout U.S. history. And with the Supreme Court's decision that money is speech, we're talking with you all this morning. Do you agree?
This is Dale from New York. This is a hideous decision by the Supreme Court. But if we look at it from the judicial aspect, they are interpreting the law. Therefore, the law needs to be clarified and changed. So presumably we have the power to call our Congress members and have them tighten the law.
Tell us what you think we should do now, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Huckaberry, and we're having this existential, it's quite literally an existential conversation with you on The Takeaway. What is free speech? Is speech money?
So if money is speech, is speech free, or is it a butterfly dreaming it's a man? It's kind of capitalism zen.
That's perfect. We've been getting lots of reactions like that. Not exactly like that, but the Supreme Court made that decision on campaign finance reform. 5-4 decision, getting rid of limits on corporate contributions. Here's what so many of you are wondering.
My name is Fred, and I'd like to know when corporations turn into citizens. I know citizens own corporations, so corporations should have no right to give huge quantities of money to somebody they don't like. Or international corporations who don't like us can do the same. This is bizarre.
It's kind of opened up a semantic can of worms here. Philosophical questions abound for our nation right now. What is a corporation? Is it a whole person, one entity made up of individual people? How does it feel?
My name is Chris Land. I'm calling from Dearborn, Michigan. My thought is that it's just absurd. Corporations are already represented politically with the individuals that work for a company and the owners of the company. All have voices in the political system.
All like butterflies dreaming that they are men. Indeed. What if corporations were people? Does that make them U.S. citizens too? Hardy wonders on thetakeaway.org. Am I missing something here? Or did the Supreme Court just grant U.S. citizenship rights, free speech, to foreigners? Halliburton, for example, is registered in the Caymans. Even corporations based in the U.S. have, in some cases, a majority of non-U.S. citizens running their boards and owning their shares. If the court majority truly believes that corporations are people, then should the corporations be held to the same standards of citizenship as individual human Americans?
There was also an interesting question from a listener. What if you want to sell out to a corporation?
This is Johnny from Michigan, and maybe I have it wrong, but it sounds to me like if I have a very weak moral compass and a need to be in the public eye, I can just find a corporate sponsor to pay for me to run for election for an office, and they will basically provide me with the funds to get that office. before, theoretically. And then do I have to wear that corporate sponsor t-shirt while I'm on CNN?
Our listeners come up with it, the NASCARization of American politics.
Yes, Grasshopper, this is getting deep.
Indeed. It is.
It's getting deep.
New wardrobe aside, there were some interesting questions many of you had, like this. What if this has happened already?
Charles calling from Detroit. Let's suppose that the corporation was named the New York Times, and it had run an unflattering story about a southern sheriff named Sullivan. Would we suppose that in that case, the New York Times would have First Amendment rights as a corporation? I think so, since one of the great grand precedents in all of First Amendment law is New York Times versus Sullivan.
Interesting. Charles is hitting on something that we've been hearing from our listeners. Unfortunately, it's nothing new to them.
This is Seneca from Detroit. Money by bribes, money by decisions, money by corruption, and that is all that is going on, and it seems like it's business as usual.
Listen to those voices. It's a fascinating
discussion.
You know,
they say money is the mother's milk of politics.
And brains are the... Brains are the coin of the realm on the takeaway listeners. That's
we
sure.
are milking some good comments here, that's for sure.
Call us with your takes at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on the website at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. Coming up, John Yoo, the lawyer and author of the Bush administration's so-called torture memos. Does he have any regrets coming up with a legal framework for that practice? We will find out in just a few minutes. But first, a check on leading stories at 47, coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. That 5-4 ruling yesterday, the Supreme Court handed lobbyists a potentially powerful weapon. Now big businesses and unions can spend as much as they want to help sway presidential and congressional elections. Darrell West of the Brookings Institution in Washington says he expects a massive jump in political spending.
Politicians are not good at self-restraint. It's unlikely that candidates are going to limit themselves when the rules allow companies to spend as much as they want. That would really be political suicide on the part of candidates.
President Obama and congressional leaders vowed to fight back against the decision. Meanwhile, the battle between Hillary Clinton and China over internet freedom continues to escalate. Yesterday, Clinton said the internet should not be heavily censored.
Just as these technologies must not be used to punish peaceful political speech, they must also not be used to persecute or silence religious minorities.
Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
Our next guest is probably always going to be known as the lawyer who wrote the so-called torture memo. John Yoo, a deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department between 01 and 03, helped establish the legal framework for the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation techniques. The memos expanded the president's power in times of war. John Yoo, now a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has written a new book that examines the history of growing executive power. Yoo's new book is called Crisis in Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. John Yoo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I saw your appearance on The Daily Show. I have to say, you know, Jon Stewart had it so in for you, and you just were the nicest guy. I mean, I'm telling you, your students must have loved that.
Well, you have to keep in mind that I've spent my career learning how to calm down unruly students who've not done the reading for class.
Oh, and that's what happened with Jon Stewart?
Exactly.
Well, what I'd like to do is, first of all, let's talk about the premise of this book, Crisis and Command. In some ways, it's a story of the change, the evolution of the Constitution, and the rise of executive power in the United States. You describe in a couple of places in the book that executive power and a president's motivation and kind of righteous use of it comes from a sense that they represent this quality of the majority's intent, that when presidents act unilaterally or try to, they believe they have the power of the majority of the American people behind them, right?
When you look at these presidents and their emergencies, they really believe they're doing what's in the nation's best interest, and they draw on the fact that they were elected. They're the only official, other than the vice president, elected by the whole country, whereas Congress is often seen or described as an accumulation of lots of special interests because they're all elected by narrow constituencies. The reason you need an executive branch is because things like the Civil War or a 9/11 happen, and we need a part of the government that can act swiftly and decisively on behalf of the country, because Congress is too slow, too riven by special interests to act decisively.
Well, let's talk about the emergency of 9/11 and your role in drafting the so-called torture memo. What was the job there? I don't quite understand it. I mean, here were these people at the Department of Justice coming to you and explicitly asking for what precisely?
It's a fairly obscure office. It's very small, only has 20 lawyers. So the question came to the Justice Department from the CIA, the National Security Council, and the White House just a few months after 9/11. We're talking about the spring of 2002. One of the leaders of Al-Qaeda, the person who's thought to be the number three leader of Al-Qaeda, was captured by our intelligence agencies, and he was not cooperating and resistant to sort of standard questioning. So the question was, what could our interrogators do that did not cross the line into torture, which no one wanted to violate that, no one wanted to violate that ban, but was tougher than what we do in the law enforcement world, which is Miranda warnings and you get a lawyer, you don't have to talk at all.
But, you know, the thing I have a problem with there is, I mean, did you really think that if you'd said, you, John, there in that obscure office had said, you can't do anything, dudes, that they would have listened to you at all?
No, that's the reason they came to lawyers in the first place. I do not believe that they had a pre-decided outcome in mind where they said, oh, we're just going to do A through Z, and we don't care what the lawyers say. If they were going to do that, why ask for a lawyer's advice at all?
All right, but you may believe that, but the administration at certain points was happy to ignore the advice of lawyers who said they were doing way too much. Isn't that the case? Which makes it sound like maybe what the CIA and the White House did was, we can go down to this obscure office in DOJ and get John Yoo. He'll do it.
Well, I'm not like Mikey and the cereal or something, if that's what you're implying. I think the point is that at this time, nobody knew what the legal standards were in this gray area between what the law enforcement process allows one to do and what the statutes prohibit, because this was an unforeseen experience which we as a country had never confronted before. The second thing is, this is a job of this office in times of war. It's not as if the people in the White House said, oh, there's this little office, let's just ask them because they'll give us the answer we want. This is the function of the office when it comes to covert action. The Justice Department signs off on almost all covert actions, and the office I was working for plays that function all the time. So this is not unusual that this office,
all right,
which is also, fine, let me say, has the last word on legal disputes within the executive branch. So there are lots of lawyers who work in the government, and they can have lots of different views. And that's not uncommon, and in fact probably welcome, that a lot of lawyers would argue about what's the legal answer for something. But the final word when there are those disputes is in the Attorney General, and the Attorney General gives that function to our office.
Do you believe, since the Obama administration appears to be continuing with the military tribunal policy under the Bush administration, that a lot of the issues and legal opinions that you drafted that are so controversial are actually going to be enshrined as legal doctrine if the Obama administration basically allows this to proceed?
I think in terms of the legal authorities, I agree with you. I think the Obama administration is drawing on many of the same constitutional principles that the Bush administration did. You mentioned military commissions. The Obama administration suggested initially they were going to shut them down, but now they're going to keep them. Detaining people without putting them into the criminal civilian jury trial process. Again, they suggested when they campaigned that this would end. Now that they're in office, they're continuing that. So they have to be drawing on the same authorities. Now, but on the other hand, in terms of the choices they're making, what to do, I think they have softened, primarily in their decisions on how to treat people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, to put him in the civilian trial system in New York City, or the Detroit Christmas Day bomber, who was almost immediately put into the law enforcement process. Those two decisions probably would not have been made by the Bush administration.
Anything you regret from those years that you developed your reputation? And obviously you have a much bigger career than that, but you are the guy who wrote the torture memo, and that's what they're going to say in the New York Times obit.
The way the journalism industry is going, I hope to outlive the New York Times at this point.
But I, let me say this.
You're good. You're good. But answer
it's
the
true.
Question,
I think I'll
counselor.
Be alive after the New York Times goes bankrupt.
No regrets?
No, let me answer your question.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, I think that I don't regret what I did. I mean, I was there. I had a job to do. I was proud to be able to help the country during a time of terrible emergency when we've been attacked. What I really – I mean, obviously, I wish we had more time. I mean, we were under enormous pressure of time and circumstances. And you might say, look, you could reach a different decision. I'm the first to say, you know, it's always possible people make mistakes, and, you know, you should look back and say, could I have done something differently? But if I was put back in the same place at the same time, I would still have made basically the same decisions. I regret that our country and I ever had to make those decisions, but I would still have made them.
John Yoo, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department. From 01 to 03, his new book is called Crisis and Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush.
You can tell he gets paid to talk.
Right? Yes, indeed.
All day today, we're covering the impact from the Supreme Court's decision that money is speech. What do you think, and what are you wondering?
This is Melanie in Columbia, South Carolina. I'm just wondering, does this apply to nonprofits? Does this apply to 501c3s? Does this apply to all the other large organizations that could do a lot of advertising and spin all of this?
I think it applies to everything.
She's got a commercial ready to go,
yeah,
it sounds
she's
like.
Ready, yeah. She's ready to fire some commercials off. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee. She'll be back on Monday.
Thanks for being here, Miles, this week. It's been
a pleasure.
Great having you. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.